on House Joint Resolution 49, and we'll open the hearing on 49 and 50 together. So that's House Joint Resolution 49 and House Joint Resolution 50. Mr. Taylor will read the staff summary, and I think he'll confirm. I think there's a dash 2 on the first one and a dash 3 on the second one.
That's 1 and 2 on the second
one. 1 and 2 on the second
one. I think 1 and 3.
Chair, members of the committee, House Joint Resolutions 49 and 50 come to you at the request of Attorney General Hardy Morris, the Department of Justice, and Steve Dole for Crime Victims United. HJR 49 amends Section 42, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution as it relates to victims' rights. And on 49, you have the dash 2 amendments, which I believe supersede the dash 1, but we may hear more about that later from one of the witnesses. The HJR 50 amends Section 43, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, once again relating to victims' rights. And you have on this one the dash 1 amendments, which comes from the Department of Justice, and I believe the dash 3, which I think, as the dash 2 and the other set, come from the ACLU.
Okay, committee members, what we're going to do is we're going to have three panels from the from the Attorney General's committee, and we'll have each one of them testify before we ask questions, please, from each panel. So we'll begin with Attorney General Myers and Mr. Steve Dole and Mr. Doug Baloof. You'll come up, please. Good morning to all of you, and Mr. Attorney General, you want to begin, and as always, of course, begin by identifying yourself.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Wisnant, members of the committee. For your record, I'm Attorney General Hardy Myers, and it's a privilege to open the committee's consideration of House Joint Resolutions 49 and 50. These measures address one of the major pieces of unfinished business in Oregon's efforts on behalf of crime victims, their rights, and the community's response to their needs in the wake of their victimization. In a few minutes, Steve Dole will address the high points of those efforts in a brief overview so that the committee has the wider historical context of these measures. From a historical standpoint, I would say for my part that it's very fitting that this committee should have these measures before it, because that effort on behalf of Oregon crime victims began in this committee 30 years ago with the shaping and reporting of the measure that established the Oregon crime victims compensation system. And it was my privilege to chair the House Committee on Judiciary in that 1977 session. Judge Mark Gardner, who will be testifying a little bit later, was also a member of that 1977 committee. The primary roots of these measures, I think, can be traced to two important developments. The first is the 2002 Oregon Crime Victims Needs Assessment, a study which the Oregon Department of Justice sponsored and financed about 4 years ago. The study results showed significant levels of non-enforcement of many crime victims' rights in Oregon, coupled also with high levels of victim uncertainty about whether a particular right had been enforced. And the percentages of those interviewed who said the right had not been enforced ranged upwards of 40 or more percent in the instance of some of the vested or granted rights. More recently, and in part as a result of that statewide needs assessment, the Oregon Department of Justice successfully sought a federal Department of Justice grant for what is called the Oregon Crime Victims Rights Compliance Project. And the mission of that project is summed up by the charge that I issued to its advisory committee. And this is the charge: work with each other to develop a coordinated plan so that within the Oregon criminal justice system, crime victims' rights will be clearly and consistently understood by crime victims, and crime victims will have every opportunity to fully exercise their rights. Every crime, every victim, every right, every case, every time. And so the work of that project has organized itself around certain basic goals: increasing victim and system awareness and understanding of victims' rights, developing a system for reporting noncompliance and for a fair and meaningful review and response to noncompliance reports, and working to develop a system for process change in response to reports of noncompliance. The project is a very worthy undertaking, and I have absolutely no doubt that it will, over time, produce improved compliance with victims' rights within the criminal justice system. But I think, speaking in all frankness, that the project has brought a sharpened realization that Oregon will only get so far with voluntary compliance in achieving the goal of consistent realization of crime victims' rights. And I think that realization, in turn, has sharpened the question, is Oregon going to be satisfied with partial compliance? Or are we going to add to our effort the ability of individual victims to invoke judicial authority to address alleged violations? In the summer of 2006, Steve Twist, the former Chief Assistant Attorney General of Arizona, and a preeminent victims' rights leader in that state, addressed the summer conference of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and he was speaking on behalf of the adoption in Oregon of a victims' enforcement authority like that in Arizona, in many other states, and has occurred at the federal level as well. From that presentation to the ODAA came a widening discussion about the change Steve's presentation had advocated. Central participants in those discussions included Scott Heiser, former Benton County District Attorney and then president of the ODAA, Steve Dole of Crime Victims United, who's here at the table, Doug Ballouf, director of the National Crime Victims Law Institute at Lewis and Clark Law School, who is also here in this panel, John Stein, former director of public affairs of the International Organization for Victim Assistance, and the current executive secretary of the International Organization for Victim Assistance. And participating for the Oregon Department of Justice were Peter Shepard, the deputy, Connie Gallagher, then head of our Crime Victims Assistance Section, and me. These discussions, in turn, spawned the drafting of the proposed measure over a period of several weeks and the endorsement of Victims Enforcement Authority at the Winter Conference of the Oregon District Attorneys Association last December. The decision to propose victim enforcement authority led immediately to a threshold question. To achieve the desired goal, is it necessary to amend the Oregon Constitution? And I want to next address that question before discussing the measures themselves, because I think that issue of need to amend is, I think, should be rightly also a threshold question of this committee. I think that should always be a question when a proposal to amend the Oregon Constitution is presented. The problem, of course, arises from the text of the existing constitutional provisions. And I want to begin with H.J.R. 49, which would propose certain amendments to Section 42 of Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, our Bill of Rights. The first section of Section 42 enumerates certain crime victims' rights. The current provisions then state, and this is on page 2 of the printed measure, lines 2 to 3, that nothing in this section is intended to create any cause of action for compensation or damages. Now, H.J.R. 49 does not propose any change to that restriction, nor to the prohibitions, the further prohibitions, at page 2, lines 3 to 5, prohibitions against using any assertion of rights to invalidate an accusatory instrument, invalidate a conviction, invalidate a juvenile proceeding adjudication, or otherwise terminate any criminal or juvenile delinquency proceeding at any point after the case is commenced or is on appeal. All of those restrictions are left undisturbed by the proposals of H.J.R. 49. However, the current provisions of the Oregon Constitution further state, and this is at lines 3 to 5 of page 2 of the printed measure, nor may this section be used to invalidate ruling of a court or otherwise suspend any criminal or juvenile delinquency proceeding at any point after the case is commenced or on appeal. Now, while the current provisions of Section 42 do not expressly prohibit the Assembly from granting individual victims enforcement authority, they effectively do so because they prohibit the enforcement of the rights from acting to overturn a court ruling or to suspend a proceeding. And such restrictions on the enforcement of rights, whoever's authorized to assert them, render the enforcement effectively meaningless, because the restrictions I just quoted would prevent providing judicial review of a trial court ruling to determine whether it was erroneous, or the opportunity to obtain a reversal of a trial court ruling denying an asserted right. Thus, in addition to the other changes I'll return to in a moment, HJR 49 proposes the deletion of that existing language that would prohibit the enforcement of a victim's rights from overturning a court ruling or suspending a proceeding. Those are gateway changes, we think, to enable an effective enforcement system to be established. Turning for a moment, HJR 50 proposes amendments to Section 43 of our Bill of Rights. In Section 43, the issue of legislative authority to grant crime victims enforcement authority by statute is presented even more sharply. First of all, Section 43, just as Section 42, has the same prohibition against use of the section with the effect of overturning a court ruling or suspending a proceeding. And that is at page 1 of the printed measure, lines 24 to 25. However, subsection 4 of section 43, and this is on page 2 of the printed measure, lines 9 to 10, provides the prosecuting attorney is the party authorized to assert the rights of the victim and the public authorized by this section. The introduced measure was supposed to propose deletion of the words the victim and in line 9, and by a drafting error that did not occur, and so the 50-1 amendments that have been distributed to you would make that change, so that the prosecuting attorney would be the attorney authorized to assert the rights of the public without reference to the victim. And HJR 50, like 49, proposes to delete the reference to ruling of a court, that's at page 2, line 4, or the suspension of criminal or juvenile delinquency proceedings, while leaving unchanged the restrictions that are the same in Section 43 as 42, dealing with creation of any cause of action for compensation or damages, using an assertion of rights to invalidate an accusatory instrument, conviction, adjudication, or to terminate any criminal or juvenile delinquency proceeding. In other words, those basic restrictions presently in the Constitution would be unaffected by either 49 or 50. Then the other changes to the Constitution proposed by 49 and 49 run basically parallel in the two measures. First, each measure provides that the prohibition against invalidating a court ruling or suspending a criminal or juvenile delinquency proceeding, that prohibition is withdrawn to the extent otherwise provided in the other subsections of the measure. Second, each measure provides that every victim shall have remedy by due course of law for violation of a right established by the pertinent section of the measure. Third, Each measure provides that a claim for right may be asserted by motion in a pending case or by mandamus proceeding if no case is pending. Fourth, each measure directs courts to give expedited consideration, including allowing an interlocutory appeal to claims for rights established in the relevant section. Fourth, each measure provides that the remedy for violation of a right is limited to injunction, order, or writ effectuating the right. Fifth, each measure provides that upon the victim's request, the prosecuting attorney, in the attorney's discretion, may assert and enforce a victim's right established in Section 42 or Section 43. Sixth, each measure provides that the Assembly may pass laws further effectuating the provisions. And then finally, H.J.R. 49, and this is at page 2, lines 22 to 24, provides that upon the filing of a prosecuting attorney's affidavit setting forth cause, a court shall suspend the rights established by Section 42 in any case involving organized crime or victims who are minors. And this provision reflects the concern by district attorneys that in the described circumstances, a person who is a victim may be particularly subject to pressure by the defendant to assert rights for the purpose of trying to somehow disrupt the process, delay or disrupt the process. In sum, Chair Wisnant and members, the two measures are intended to remove any current provisions of Sections 42 and 43 that would prevent effectively authorizing victims to assert violations of rights established by those sections. And then the two measures propose certain basic features or aspects of that remedial process while leaving the Assembly empowered to further effectuate the enforcement authority. It will, of course, be a further question the committee will be examining as to whether each of the proposed specifics about the enforcement process that are included are appropriate for the Constitution as opposed to being left for statute. And that's a conversation that I look forward to our having. I would only say at this point that the recommendations in the measure are intended both to create authorizations, if you will, but also to place limits. In effect, place limits on the legislature in further effectuating the measure so that these further provisions specify what procedural steps are to be taken and where they are to be taken to assert the right. They mandate expedited judicial review, and there may be a constitutional question as to how far the legislature can go in directing courts to give expedited review to cases. In other words, careful consideration was given as to whether each of the further provisions was one that we thought it would be wise to embody in the Constitution incident to a basic grant of enforcement rights. With that, Chair Wisnant, I'd like to conclude my testimony and if it would be agreeable to have Steve Dole testify.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Thank you for your enthusiasm and your presentation of this. And after 30 years, we hope the committee can answer those questions with you and get these two resolutions passed. And another member of your panel who's worked hard for victims' rights, Mr. Dole. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I am the president of Crime Victims United of Oregon and a member of the Attorney General's Advisory Committee, Oregon Crime Victims' Rights Compliance Implementation Project, and the Attorney General's Task Force on Restitution. It is an honor to have Attorney General Harding Myers as a requester with us on HJR 49 and 50, and it is also appropriate and fitting that we hold these hearings today, which is Crime Victims Awareness Day here in the Capitol. Crime Victims United supports HJR 49 and 50, and we ask you to pass these resolutions out of committee and onto the floor of the House. The Attorney General was right when he stated that the victims' rights movement in Oregon began with the Crime Victims Compensation Bill in 1977. 3 years after the passage of that bill, a vicious crime took place in San Francisco, California, that would impact the victims' rights movement here in Oregon for the next 26 years. Valerie McDonald, the daughter of Oregonians Bob and Dee Dee Coons, and a recent graduate of the San Francisco Art Institute, was abducted and murdered in November of 1980. Her remains were recovered in 1991 in the floodplain of the Kettle River, 1 mile from the Canadian border in Ferry County, Washington. The remains were identified in late 2000, and her parents were notified in January of 2001 that Valerie had at long last been found. This tragedy led Bob and Dee Dee to the Parents of Murdered Children chapter in Portland, where they learned of the mistreatment of victims by the criminal justice system. They founded Crime Victims United in 1983 to address this injustice, and since then CVU has been the resource to which Oregon crime victims turn when their rights are violated. In 1984, CVU placed the first crime victims' rights statutory provision, Measure 8, on the ballot, which was narrowly defeated. In 1986, they followed with another statutory initiative, Measure 10, which was overwhelmingly passed by the voters. In 1996, ballot Measure 40, which would enshrine victims' rights in the state constitution, was passed by the people. In 1998, the Supreme Court of Oregon invalidated Measure 40, not on substantive, but rather on technical grounds, now known as the Armada decision. In 1999, the legislature referred 7 of the 9 sections of Measure 40 to the voters, 4 of which passed. 2 ballot measures, 69 and 71, which became sections 42 and 43 of Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution. These are the sections to be amended by HJR 49 and 50. HJ 49 and 50 will allow victims to defend their constitutional rights on appeal when violated. Presently, there are 34 states which have adopted constitutional rights for crime victims. Only 2 of those states, Oregon and Virginia, are without standing or remedy for those rights. In hindsight, it was with an overabundance of caution that the issue of standing was not placed in Measure 40 or the subsequent measures referred by the legislature. However, it is notable that the members of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, who were most concerned about this issue at the time, now stand with us today in support of HJR 49 and 50, and we're delighted to have the president of the association, John Foote, who will testify to you a little bit later on. The reason for HJR 49 and 50 is simply that the current rights are illusory without remedy if they are violated, and they must be placed in the Constitution because currently, as Attorney General Hardy Myers stated, the Constitution prohibits remedy. Some examples of why victims should have standing in the courts. The Harberts case. Scott Dean Harbert sexually assaulted and murdered 2-year-old Christina Lynn Hornich in 1989. He was found guilty of aggravated murder. The Oregon Supreme Court released him from death row and out of prison in 2000, not because he was innocent, but because of his claim of denial of the right to a speedy trial. Little Christina's mother was notified not by the court, and the court did not notify the district attorney's office and the victim's assistants to notify the mother, but rather by the reporter knocking on her door to ask her, how do you feel about the release of Scott Dean Harberts? Another recent case on notification is the case of Dr. Burleson in Multnomah County. This might be one of the ultimate cases when it comes to notification. This is a doctor who was placing women in a state of incapacitation and then sexually assaulting these women. And a judge made a decision in this case. Basically, it reminds me of something my father used to say to me, what you don't know won't hurt you. This judge decided that these women should not be should not know about their victimization, so that they cannot access any victim services. They have no rights. And part of what the Constitution says is it mandates that victims be afforded a meaningful role in the criminal justice system proceedings and be protected from their offenders. Well, how can you do that if you don't know you've had a criminal act perpetrated upon you? Further, from personal experience, I can tell you of the right to give a victim's impact statement being denied. In my case, when a judge said after family flew in from Los Angeles and Chicago that he wasn't going to hear us. Of defense attorney investigators attempting to interview victims through misrepresenting themselves by stating that they were with the DA's office. I have personally spoken to victims who experienced district attorneys failing to consult with them in plea negotiations or moving forward with a plea agreement different from one that they were advised of. I have tried to help victims who were not notified of parole board and psychiatric review board hearings. And finally, victims continually call on CVU when their right to receive restitution from the criminal has been violated. All you need to know on the subject of restitution is that less than 20% of restitution is collected in Oregon, and there is no recourse for the victim. In the 2002 Oregon Crime Victims Needs Assessment Final Report done by Portland State that General Myers mentioned, the section on crime victims' rights illuminates the problem as summarized, and this is the report. It's summarized on the table from page 66 of this report, and I've included it on page 3 of my testimony. And I won't go through that, but I think when you get a chance, if you read that, it demonstrates the problem. You know, we spend lots of time in this building concerning ourselves with the rights of the accused and convicted, as we should. One of my mentors in the crime victims movement, Bob Coons, once said, without victims, there would be no need for a criminal justice system. If we could return all the property, heal all the injuries, both psychological and physical, and raise the dead, we wouldn't need the system. But we all know that that is not possible, so we now ask you to think about the rights of victims. Lastly, as you consider this matter, I would ask you to reflect on the profound words of a father in the Long Island, New York chapter of Parents of Murdered Children, expressing his dismay and disappointment about the treatment he received in the criminal justice system. He stated, "All we ask is to be treated like criminals. All we ask from you is for standing and remedy for victims of crime whose rights have been violated." Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for your time. I appreciate it, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Dole. Thank you for all your work and leadership. And we'll have questions panel committee after the panel completes. Professor Baloof.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair, honorable members of the committee, and thank you for your public service in the legislature. My name is Douglas Baloof. I'm professor of law and director of the National Crime Victim Law Institute at Lewis and Clark Law School up in Portland. By way of background, I've worked with the United States Senate on legislation concerning crime victims' rights, legislation that includes enforcement and standing for violations of victims' rights. I've been cited by them as a leading authority on crime victim law. I've written numerous scholarly articles concerning victim law, received an award from the United States Attorney General for professional innovation and victim services for my work establishing pro bono victim clinics around the country and assisting them with the laws of the United States. I was named by Oregon Business Magazine in 2006 as one of 50 leaders and 10 pioneering leaders in the state of Oregon for my work in victim law and legal services. I consult with legislators nationwide and have argued victim law issues in state Supreme Courts, both on my own and at the request of state attorney generals. The National Crime Victim Law Institute, which I direct, submits amicus briefs to appellate courts nationwide, advises crime victim lawyers nationwide, We participate in cases in briefings before the United States Supreme Court. In my scholarly academic and political activities, I have learned about the nation state of victims' rights. Oregon lags behind the federal government and the majority of states because in Oregon, victims can't enforce their rights in the courts. Federal law gives victims standing to enforce their rights. And of the 34 states with constitutional rights, the vast majority explicitly or implicitly allow victims to enforce their rights on review. The present version of Oregon's constitutional rights, as Mr. Dole has characterized them, are illusory. In an American system of justice, real rights are rights which we can defend in the courts. Crime victims' rights in Oregon are presently unenforceable in the traditional American model. There are only two states, Oregon being one of them, that have eliminated both any ability to obtain a stay to obtain review of constitutional rights, and that's one of the provisions the general indicated we needed to remove, or the ability to challenge any court ruling, the other provision in the present Constitution that the general suggests be removed. The central reason for this constrained version of rights in Oregon, and I was around at the time myself, was an overabundance of caution. Whenever new laws are passed impacting a system of justice, there's understandably caution. And most of this caution came from the prosecuting attorneys in the states. There was a concern that victims' rights not clog up the criminal justice process or interfere with the state's ability to pursue justice in criminal cases. In the intervening years, there's been substantial experience both in federal and state jurisdictions where victims have standing to enforce their rights. This experience has provided significant comfort that, first, enforceable rights will not negatively impact the criminal process. Second, that it does not present the danger of a significant cost to the parties or the courts to provide for enforcement. Contrary to the dire predictions of naysayers, victims' rights did not cause the sky to fall in any of these other jurisdictions, nor will the standing in this bill cause it to fall here in Oregon. The primary reason, of course, for providing standing to victims is to accord victims meaningful, that is, real rights, rather than the illusory rights they presently possess. There are other more fundamental structural, constitutional, and legal reasons why these bills are sound and good for the state of Oregon. These other reasons have a lot to do with keeping constitutional structure and judicial order in place. First, when victims don't have standing, it puts trial courts rather than appellate courts in the position of being the ultimate determiners of what a constitutional right means. And that means that the system is essentially upside down. In an American system of rights, the courts that define the scope of rights and the meaning of rights are the appellate courts. Without the ability to pursue a violation of rights into appellate courts, each trial court can arrive at its own unique conclusion about the meaning of a given right. Moreover, trial courts can apply their disparate notions about what a right does or doesn't mean without fear of contradiction on review. The result is different rights for different victims, depending upon which trial judge they draw. Second, providing victims standing to enforce something like an evidentiary privilege, which is a statutory protection, and then to deny them the ability to enforce a right of constitutional dimension makes little sense. Thus, in Oregon, a victim successfully obtained appellate review of a trial court's order to allow an inspection of a victim's home, but an Oregon victim cannot seek review of a denial of a constitutional right. So there is a disparity between the ability to enforce statutory privileges and the inability to enforce constitutional rights, which again doesn't fit with the traditional American model of rights enforcement. Third, no victim standing prevents adversity in the litigation of rights. Our system is founded on the idea that there are adverse parties who come together to litigate particular issues, and that in the heat of adversity, the issues will sharpen and come to a point at which appellate courts can then take the issue and determine what the answer is. Without victims litigating, being able to enforce their rights, there is no pure adversary in front of the court concerning what the scope of that right should be, or whether the right should apply in a given situation. The Fourth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals summed up this point best when it allowed rape victims to appeal an adverse ruling about whether prior sexual conduct of a rape victim should come in the federal system. Quote, no other party in the evidentiary proceeding shares these interests in the rape shield to the extent that they might be viewed as a champion of victims' rights. So there's also a dysfunction in law, because not only have we gone outside the American constitutional model, not only have we turned the hierarchy of the courts upside down, but we have also adversely affected the adversary process itself by not including victims as people who can enforce their rights. Fourth, when prosecutors possess exclusive control over victims' rights, such a structure provides fertile grounds for conflicts of interest. It is simply not fair to expect prosecutors to enforce victims' rights when what they are sworn to uphold is the public interest, and when it is possible that the public interest and victims' rights may come into conflict. They should not be reasonably expected to seek review and reversal of actions they take in the public interest. Finally, victims' rights without enforcement are destructive to a traditional model of civil rights. Perhaps the most famous opinion ever decided by the Supreme Court, Marbury versus Madison, provided that rights without remedy are no rights at all. So the great weight of constitutional tradition and judicial structure behind these bills, in addition to the fact that it's simply fair for victims to be able to enforce their rights. The question remains whether there are substantial reasons in opposition to this legislation, and there are none. First, it might be argued that giving victims standing to enforce these rights may clog up the courts. But before I came down here, I asked a paralegal who works for me to survey 5 states. I just picked these states. I knew these states provided standing for victims. And I asked them to figure out how many opinions, written opinions in appellate courts, had occurred in these states since standing became available to victims to enforce their rights. And here are the numbers he came up with. At by far the greatest number of cases is Arizona, where they have an active victims clinic and have probably the longest-lived victim clinic in the country, and have had standing since 1991. The average appellate court opinion that substantively deals with these rights average 1 every 3 years. In Nevada, since 1996, there haven't been any opinions, but in reviewing Nevada, I found out they also have a provision which does not allow stays, so that might explain that. South Carolina, since 1996, 1 opinion every 5 years. Texas, since 1989, 1 opinion every 8 years. And Utah, since 1999, 1 opinion every 8 years. So experience argues that the courts will not be overwhelmed, they will not be burdened. On the other hand, you might say, well, if there are these few opinions, is it worth the candle? And the answer is yes. And the reason the answer is yes is one opinion that addresses victims' rights can clarify an entire set of problems that trial courts face, such as how to give notice, who's responsible for notice. And this is the way the system should work. You, as the legislature, pass laws. When people disagree about what they mean, they seek clarity from the courts. Hopefully the courts provide that clarity. This is how rights have worked since the Bill of Rights was written. Second, it might be asked whether victims standing to defend their rights might be accomplished without amending the Constitution. The answer is clearly no, and in an article I wrote in 2005 before this change was contemplated before this legislature, I looked at the Oregon law, and it was my opinion before there was a bill behind my opinion that the Oregon law could not be amended legislatively. It would have to be amended constitutionally for the reasons articulated by the general. So in conclusion, an amendment to the Constitution is needed to provide victims meaningful rights, to bring the rights in conformance with constitutional norms for civil liberties, and to bring them within a conventional judicial structure. For all these reasons, I implore you to pass the bill to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, committee members and our panel members. And now, committee members, we've heard a lot. Hope there's a lot of meat here, so hope you have some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Thank you, distinguished panel. I have a question about restitution in general. Under existing law, if a criminal defendant is ordered to pay restitution to a victim, what process is followed if that restitution isn't paid? I would find it hard to believe that there isn't anything that would put some teeth into that order. So
I would actually defer that, because both the Attorney General and Steve Dole work with a restitution task force, which I am not privy to. So,
Chair Wisnant, Representative Bonamici, under present law, when an order of restitution is entered, there will also be a payment schedule that is established based on the ability of that particular defendant to pay. Whereas prior to 2003, the law had made ability to pay a factor in entering an order of restitution at all. Now that ability bears on the payment schedule. And I think there have been different mechanisms that have been followed to try to enforce those payment schedules. I think in some counties there have been restitution collection teams, if you will, that have been established that monitor the cohort of the defendants, at least some number of them, against whom restitution orders are entered. And to the extent that those orders are being departed from, they are called in for a meeting and for further direction. I think that has been to date the most effective mechanism that's being used in order to try to stay on top of those enforcement orders. Certainly collection remains, I think, is now the great area of challenge, since I think the law itself has been of entitlement to restitution, I think, has pretty well been straightened out.
Thank you. Follow-up, please. I raise that because it seems to be the number one concern of victims, that they aren't getting the restitution, and I hope that whatever we would do with this would help that process happen. And, you know, but to use the old can't get blood from a turnip, I don't know that we're going to put any blood back in the turnip with this, but I would hope that it would at least facilitate that ability to collect. And further follow-up, Mr. Vice Chair, unrelated question. It looks like the number two concern is the lack of ability to get a transcript, and I wonder if there's some procedure now to inform victims that they have to request it. It's not automatic, because is it a communication issue that victims don't know that they need to request a transcript, or is it just that they aren't getting it for some reason that hopefully can be remedied by this?
Well, I guess I may come at this not the way that you'd like, but we are working very hard with a compliance committee to create systems where victims are informed of all their rights and all their resources. And this is a committee of the Attorney General mentioned by Mr. Dole. What I do know is that a similar effort was made in 2000 in Denver to create better compliance with state agencies and the judiciary around victims' rights, and that recently they have been consulting the National Crime Victim Law Institute in order to take this further step of making sure they are enforcing their rights. in the courts, as we are doing now. So I think, you know, the best answer I can give you, I think, is how do we make this darn thing work? And I think the way we make this darn thing work is we come at it from a variety of places. We come at it from trying to get all the agencies to have model best practices, and they're working hard on that. But we also ultimately have to have some way of enforcing the law. Should it simply be ignored, even if no one's being evil or wrong, if they simply care not to to take it upon themselves to comply with it? So where Oregon is going between the compliance committee and this legislation is probably maximizing the potential for victims and their rights not to fall through the cracks or to be neglected.
Thank you. And I have one more follow-up, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I don't hate to monopolize the time. I'm concerned about on the HJR 49, page 2, the provision that Attorney General Myers talked about where the victim may be pressured to assert the rights to delay in cases involving organized crime or victims who are minors. I'm concerned mm-hmm. about the restrictive language. It says the court shall suspend the rights established in this section, that perhaps that doesn't give flexibility to a judge who may find it appropriate to perhaps enforce some of the rights but not all of them. For example, if they want to enforce restitution but not something else, they don't have that flexibility under that section. And I wonder if there's a reason for that, if you maybe considered may suspend or modify some of the rights to give flexibility when it's in the victim's interest to enforce some of them but not in the interest to enforce others.
Well, Chair Wisnant, Representative Bonamici, it's a policy issue, of course, as to whether a restriction of this kind is made mandatory on the court or optional. It was drawn the way it was based on the strength of the district attorney's concerns about the potential in these two situations for manipulation of the victim. And, of course, it does require an affidavit setting forth cause. So it's not just a request that this happen that triggers the requirement. There has to be a cause demonstrated. District Attorney Foote will be testifying in a bit. Representative Bonamici and I, he might well have some further DA perspective on it, but it was a DA-generated concern that led to this provision in the first place.
Thank you.
If I may, my understanding also is that the concern was if the process for removing members of organized crime or children who were being manipulated by essentially their abusers was not simple, then the manipulation of the process would simply be moved into the hearing about whether the rights should be taken away or not, if you see what I mean. So the concern was that the potential for that kind of manipulation and disruption would simply move from one type of hearing into another type of hearing.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, panel, Mr. Attorney General. Yes, Counsel, go ahead.
Attorney General Myers, one of the key components of both constitutional amendments is whether someone's a victim, because only do you have rights if you're a victim. Victim means any person determined by the prosecuting attorney to have suffered direct financial, psychological, or physical harm as a result of a crime. One of the questions I have to you, Mr. Myers, is it's in both provisions, it's totally up to the prosecuting attorney. In many cases, sometimes, particularly if the victim and the perpetrator know each other, sometimes there's a change of heart. How would a victim, a person who contends they're a victim, how could they challenge the ruling of the prosecuting attorney, particularly when it's not an order of the court? And then how would they challenge it?
Chair Wisnant, Mr. Taylor, I think that there might be at least two different procedural avenues. One would be a motion filed in court for an order directing the district attorney to accord that recognition. It's a factual issue, of course, and that would be subject to judicial review. If there is a case actually pending, that would be the procedure mandated by this measure. If there is not a case, then it would be by mandamus to the district attorney to compel the district attorney to accord the individual the rights provided by the section. I think those are the two procedural mechanisms that would be used to to get judicial review, if you will, of a district attorney's denial of victim status to an individual.
Thank you. If I may, Counsel Taylor, my reading of this, it may be different than yours. I think once a prosecuting attorney has issued a charge and signed that document, they have determined that this person is a victim. That person is listed in the charging instrument as a victim. And I think my interpretation is bolstered by the present legislation, which seeks to exempt, in some cases where an affidavit is prepared, members of organized crime or minor victims of crime from the ability to exercise these rights. That would not be necessary if it was, if your interpretation was the interpretation of this. I think yes, it says determined by a prosecuting attorney, but I think a prosecuting attorney would be awfully hard pressed to say, I have decided this person isn't a victim, even though I have worked with the grand jury, issued a document, signed that charging instrument, and it has the victim's name in the charging instrument. So I'm not sure that the scope of this language creates the problem that you suggest.
Chairman's committee, I'm not suggesting a problem, just asking a question for clarification on the record.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the way you've answered the questions. I've had panels here for I don't know how many years in judiciary, and I think the answers we got in the presentation is probably one of the best that I've seen. I really appreciate the work you've done.
Thank you, sir.
Always bring your lawyers with you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Attorney General, Steve, and Professor. The next panel, they'll come forward, please. District Attorney Foote, Judge Gardner, and Kim Larson, please.
We haven't really talked about who should go first, perhaps. How should we do it? Should I go? Would you like to go?
Go ahead.
Perhaps you should go.
Spend the time. Please identify yourself as you begin.
Good morning, Chair Wisnant and members of the committee. My name is Kim Larson, and I'm the Director of Marion County Victim Assistance here in Salem with the District Attorney's Office. And I appreciate the opportunity this morning to come and talk to you and represent the views of other victim assistance programs across the state. I also come to you with the perspective of a victim advocate who has worked within the criminal justice system and worked with victims of crime to help them exercise their rights. As you may be aware, all 36 district attorney's offices in Oregon have victim assistance programs. And the victim advocates within those programs work with victims of crime to make sure that they know what their rights are and to make sure that they know how to exercise them and support them in exercising those rights if that's what they choose to do. In the course of advocacy within the system, we often talk about how the system works, why it works the way it does. This often leads to a discussion about defendants' rights because that contributes to why the system works the way it does. And often after we have that discussion, the question is raised about what about my rights? Do I have rights? And allows us to have the opportunity to talk to people about what rights they do have. What's interesting is that we just generally don't hear from folks about asking the question, what if my rights aren't recognized? What happens if my rights aren't violated? And I think primarily that question doesn't come up a lot because I think people have this fundamental belief that if there's rights in the Constitution of our state, that those rights come with a way to enforce them and that there's something that people can do about it if their rights aren't recognized. Advocates and victims sit in the courtrooms every day and watch as everybody in the courtroom is very busy protecting the rights of the defendants, making sure their rights are recognized, whether it's the right to a speedy trial, whether it's a right to a lawyer, whether it's the right to have evidence suppressed if it wasn't collected properly. All those rights are very closely held and very vigorously protected in our criminal justice system. And all of us would probably admit that if we were charged with crimes, we would want those protections as well. and we would want somebody that's zealously advocating for us on our behalf within the court system to make sure our rights are protected. And certainly, although victims of crime have rights and have rights that they haven't had in recent past history, their rights really pale in comparison to the rights of defendants. And the protection of those rights is very different within the court system. The courts, understandably so, spend a great deal of time very vigorously protecting the rights of criminal defendants and making sure that if they're not recognized, that there's a remedy. For me, probably one of the greatest distinctions between victims' rights and criminal defendants' rights is that if a defendant's rights aren't recognized, something drastic or something bad usually happens, whether that's a case is dismissed, whether a defendant is let out of jail, or evidence doesn't come in that wasn't collected properly, or charges are dropped, or a case has to be retried. All of those things are things that we see happen as a result of defendants' rights not being recognized. So the question is, what happens when victims' rights aren't recognized? Maybe they'll get an apology. That's what they get. And as you can imagine, that's not very satisfying to victims whose rights haven't been recognized. Probably one of the hardest things that we do as advocates within the criminal justice system is have those conversations with victims. After we have spent the time explaining that they do have rights, to have to then go back and tell them, yeah, you had rights, but they weren't recognized and they were ignored. Not only at that point has the criminal defendant chosen to victimize that victim, but at that point the system has chosen to victimize the victim as well. And their opportunity to participate has been taken away from them, and their voice has been silenced. One of the most common rights that we see victims choose to exercise is the right to make a statement at sentencing. And I've worked with several victims who have made that choice. They want to make a statement to the judge to let the judge know how the case and how the crime has impacted them. They don't feel like just a recitation of the crimes really accurately reflects what the impact has been. So victims stand up and they bare their souls about all of the impact, whether it's a lack of trust that they now have, whether it's a continual fear that they now live with daily, or whether it's just this description of a continual emotional roller coaster that they experience. They also talk about dissolution of marriages because of the stress created by the victimization. And they talk about their children turning to alcohol or drugs and sometimes suicide because of the inability to cope with their victimization. All of these things are important for victims to be able to explain to judges so they understand the full impact of the crime. And for many, this fills their need to be heard by the system. For some, it's part of their healing process, and for some, it simply gives them the opportunity to be heard in a system that they felt at that point hadn't been listening to them. Unfortunately, I've also been on the other side of working with victims who did want to exercise that right and weren't afforded that opportunity. And I've had to have those difficult conversations that always start with, "I'm so sorry." And that's all that I can tell them. That's all they can offer them. There isn't any remedy or recourse for them. And after just listening to their frustrations and their deep sense of injustice, the question always follows, but what about my rights? I had rights too, and those weren't recognized. Unfortunately, there's no good answer to this question. What we know is that of all the states that have victims' rights in their constitution, Oregon is one of only two that don't provide a remedy for victims. And this effectively takes the voice away from victims and being able to exercise their rights. Certainly, having victims' rights within our constitution gives victims a voice in the system, but their voice is silenced when their rights aren't recognized and they have absolutely no remedy for that. Only when victims are a recognized part of the process and have a remedy for that violation will their voices truly be heard. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak this morning.
Thank you very much.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning. My name is John Foote, and I serve as a Clackamas County District Attorney and also currently the president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And I'm primarily here to express the strong support of our organization for these measures. We believe they are the next right important step for victims in Oregon.
Victims' rights began as a revolution back in the early 1980s with the help and leadership of people like Bob and Dee Dee Coons. Dee Dee's here today, witnessing the next step, and Steve Dole. And this process has been, quite candidly, an educational process for prosecutors. I think it has been for police. I think it has been for everybody in the system, judges. We're being educated about why this is all important and why it can fit with the jobs that we do. And that's what prosecutors believe these resolutions are important new steps for us. You heard about the history of the process and how prosecutors had been concerned about this, but I honestly believe they've looked at other states and realized that this can simply supplement what's already going on and make sure that victims have a way to participate. So we believe it strikes the right balance in the system and will be a great tool for victims when, in fact, their rights are not recognized, whether it's by our offices or by the courts or which are the two primary places that can happen. So I know there will be questions. I'll be glad to answer them specifically, but I really wanted to let you know that the district attorneys in Oregon support these measures. We believe in them. We think it's the right time. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Judge Gardner.
Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, my name is Mark Gardner. I'm a circuit court judge for Washington County, and I've served in that capacity for over 25 years. I've also served as special counsel to Attorney General Hardy Myers. Prior to my service as a circuit court judge, I was a member of the Oregon House of Representatives and served as chairman of this committee in 1979. I serve in a couple leadership positions in the judiciary, but today I only represent myself here. I support H.R. 49 and 50. I believe the enactment of these measures after a vote of the people will allow crime victims to assert the rights they've been granted by the Oregon Constitution rather than relying on someone else to do so for them. In the vast majority of cases, having the prosecutor assert the crime victim's constitutional rights works well. However, there are exceptions. Sometimes crime victims do not receive the notice necessary to become actively involved in the criminal justice process. This can occur for a number of reasons. Crime victims move and fail to provide the court or the prosecutors a change of address. On rare occasions, prosecutors fail to notify the crime victims through oversight. Sometimes crime victims receive notice but don't understand the significance of a court hearing or how they need to become involved in the process. I believe that the language in both H.R. 49 and 50, giving the legislature the authority to enact legislation to, quote-unquote, effectuate these rights, contained in the Constitution, along with an analysis of the notices given to crime victims and how they respond to those notices, will allow the legislature to draft laws to increase crime victims' participation in the process. I have learned that in a 2002 survey of crime victims, it was found that between one quarter and one half of the crime victims felt that one or more of their constitutional rights had not been enforced. Particularly of concern were the rights to receive a transcript of the proceedings in open court and the right to receive prompt restitution, where more than half of the crime victims felt that the rights had not been met. Personally, I have observed problems with crime victims asserting their constitutional rights regarding receiving prompt restitution. It can occur in the following scenario. The crime victim is notified in a timely manner to make a request for restitution at the time of sentencing. At sentencing, the court hears from the crime victim and orders restitution. Months later, the convicted defendant has failed to make payments as ordered. The crime victim is frustrated and contacts the district attorney. The district attorney tells the crime victim to contact either the probation officer or the sentencing judge directly. The crime victim sends letters to both, and sometimes a hearing may get scheduled, and sometimes it may not. H.R. 49 will allow the crime victim to directly initiate a hearing with the court in an attempt to collect the restitution due to them. There is no question that enactment of these measures by the committee and ultimately by the people of Oregon, coupled by additional legislation that will be needed to delineate the processes necessary to enforce these constitutional rights, will require more time, effort, and expense by the participants in the criminal justice system, but it is a small price to pay for the kind of system we need to truly provide justice. Thank you, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Judge. Committee members, questions for this panel?
Mr. Vice Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Representative Wisnant. I'm sorry I had to return a phone call. I'm sorry if I missed any discussion about my concern about HJR 49 that in the section that deals with the minor victim or the case involving organized crime. And I wondered if you had addressed that issue or had thoughts on why that is a provision that's written so that the court shall suspend the rights established in the section, because I wonder if it would be better to have some flexibility in that area.
Chair Wisnant, Senator Bonamici, members of the committee, I think Professor Ballouf really captured the point, which is it's hard to capture here what the dynamics of a child case in which the abuser perhaps is in the family and the difficulty that that can place. I had a case years ago in which the grandmother actually abducted the child, took the child to California, made a tape of the child recanting, and brought the child back. So it's difficult to imagine here why it would be necessary to have such strong language. I think the discretion is in the facts that are alleged in the affidavit, which must be sufficient. And I think it's important to have strong language in the provision so that if the language is there, the order will be written. If we don't have that protection, I think it will make it, we'll have some victims who, in fact, are our most vulnerable, who will be more exposed. So we like the language as it is. We'd be glad to discuss if there are suggested changes, but we think the language that's in here is the appropriate way to address it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Committee members, no other questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the next panel will be Ms. Laberton, Mary Eldridge, and John Stein, please. To you, if you'll please identify yourself before you begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Wisnant and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Beth Laberton, and I'm an advocate with Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service. We have written testimony from our director, Jane Downing, who was ill today and unable to join us. I don't want to repeat a lot of the great testimony that we've heard today, but we are just here to say that we are in full support of House Joint Resolution 49 and 50. Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service has been serving survivors of domestic and sexual violence for over 32 years. And as advocates, we are trained, we know how to help women who have been victimized by an individual. However, when the criminal justice system overlooks a victim's rights, they can be re-victimized all over again. And it's very difficult for us to explain that there is no recourse right now. So we are thrilled with the idea of enforceable remedies. This will empower victims and give them back that sense of control that they have lost in the midst of the crime. And so we applaud the Attorney General and his team and are in full support of HJR 49 and 50. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I hope you can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah,
no. It's truly an honor to be able to speak to you today. This means so much to my organization. My name is Mary Elledge, and I'm testifying and presenting information before you today as chapter leader of the Greater Portland Chapter of Parents of Murdered Children and Other Survivors of Homicide. On July 13, 1986, my son was brutally murdered by three men in our home. Our case was one of the first homicide cases in Clackamas County that allowed the co-victims of the homicide in the courtroom. I will never forget the anguish my family and I faced when we had to wait to see if the judge in our case would grant us a right to be in the courtroom during the trial. Though we were one of the first cases to use this right, many victims and co-victims have still been refused this right and many other rights under Oregon's Bill of Rights for Victims. As the sentencing for the three men who murdered our son approached, we again had to wait to see if the judge would allow us to speak about sentencing and the effect of the murder on our lives. Though given the rights, victims and co-victims of crimes need enforceable remedies to know they will be allowed these rights. We continue to re-victimize victims and co-victims, making them beg for the rights that was given to them. In our case, we were allowed to speak in the courtroom, but I'm here today to tell you of just one of the many cases in which co-victims of homicide were not allowed to speak to the court before sentencing. The case I'm referring to is the murder trial for Dayton Leroy Rogers in Clackamas County in 1990. Rogers was convicted of the kidnapping, torture, and murder of seven women. Because of his many victims, there were numerous family members. The trial lasted for 58 days. It was a nightmare for each of the families. Rogers tortured each of the women before he murdered them. He also cut off the feet of his victims. We were able to know of his many tortures because a few of the victims had escaped. They testified at the trial to the abuse and the torture he submitted them to. Because Oregon had not had victims' rights for long, the district attorney in the case thought it would be best not to have the co-victim speak at the sentencing. He believed they had the right, but was afraid of causing a mistrial if their impact statements were later challenged and called prejudicial if the jury returned the death penalty. The family members agreed because to have to go through another trial would have been unbearable. Out of fear of a mistrial, they waived their rights to speak at a sentencing. Their sacrifice went for nothing, and their worst fears, were realized. 4 years later, the families again were called back to court for the first retrial since Dayton Rogers won an appeal challenging his death penalty. This trial lasted for 27 days. The families had to hear all over again how their loved ones were tortured, mutilated, and murdered. Victims who survived his attacks also had to relive the nightmare. Roger had subjected them to. The death penalty was again imposed. Again, the families were not given permission to make victim statements at sentencing, or at least were strongly discouraged from doing so. In 2006, a third trial was held again to challenge the death penalty. This last trial was even harder on the families and friends of the seven women who were brutally murdered. It lasted for 22 days. The families of the murder victims had been living this nightmare for over 15 years, and now they saw Rogers again, appearing healthy and smiling at them. Again, families were hearing what their daughters, mothers, or sisters had endured in the last hours before they were murdered. At this trial, some were told that they might be able to testify before sentencing, but would have to wait for the judge's permission. Most of the co-victims were cautious about getting their hopes up. The night before sentencing, they were still not told if they would be able to speak for their loved ones. Not surprisingly, one of the mothers simply chose not to go. She had no idea that the ban on the co-victim speaking would finally be lifted. So she decided it would be a waste of time and heartache to attend. She had already spent 113 days in trials and hearings. As I recall, it wasn't until after the jury once more voted for the death penalty when the judge told the families they could make a statement. Many of the family members had not prepared a statement because it is very painful to write a statement when you don't even know if you'll be able to present it. Even those who had thoughts in order had not done what we might call the emotional homework. I remember before my son's sentencing, I probably read what I wanted to say maybe 30 times so that I could do it without crying. So the family member who spoke talked just, the first family member who spoke talked just from the floor. And the rest who followed spoke at the same place, since they were not invited to take the witness stand and be seated as in the custom in presenting impact statements. Many of the co-victims had trouble putting words to what they had to say. It was clear the offer to speak came as a surprise. Others tried to speak, but could do little more than cry. It felt as if their voices didn't matter. As the mother of a murdered child and the chapter leader of Parents of Murdered Children, it was painful to see so many of my friends put in such a state. This violated an important purpose of giving victims a voice. Looking back on these trials, three things stand out. The family members believed they had a right to speak in the first two hearings, but were persuaded not to. I don't think they really felt they really owned the right, so it never occurred to them to get their own attorney or to see if there was some way they could find out whether impact statements were really out of bounds in capital cases. Second, I feel certain that the prosecutor in the third case tried to get an early ruling on the family member's desire to speak, but barely succeeded, and then only at the last minute. If that right had really belonged to the victims from the outset, they would not have had to rely on the prosecutor's efforts or the judge's timetable. They could have had a just resolution of the issue from the onset. It was, or it should have been, their right. And third, as I said, I am almost certain that the last-minute offer to let the victim speak was made only after the jury had already decided Peyton Rogers' fate. So even if the court had given all the family members advance notice of its decision to let them speak, and even if they had been treated more politely in providing them a seat in the witness stand, their right to present an impact statement would still have been violated. A primary purpose of that law is to help inform people who have to set a sentence for a convicted offender. Family members in the capital murder trial of Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City mass murderer, were allowed to speak to the sentencing jury. My friends in the Rogers mass murder case were not. Their constitutional rights were violated, and they had no way to protect or appeal or reverse the unjust decisions. The only way victims of crime in Oregon will ever be able to receive the rights they were promised is to have enforceable remedies. We will only get what they want to give us at trials and hearings without remedies. Please help give victims and co-victims of crime a voice. I urge you to refer H.J.R. 49 and H.J.R. 50 to the people for their approval in the general election to be held in November of 2008. Please help balance the justice system, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mrs. Eldridge. Mr. Stein.
My name is John Stein, Mr. Chair and members. I have for 25 years been the Director of Public Affairs for the National Organization for Victim Assistance, most of that time in my old hometown of Washington, D.C. In more recent times, I've been serving in the same capacity here in Oregon as a long-distance victim advocate, retired in January, and now serve in service for the International Organization for Victim Assistance, which seeks to do this kind of work worldwide. Doug Ballouf made mention of some of the honors he's earned over the years, and all of them well-deserved. He promised me to indicate that I, too, got the U.S. Attorney General's award some while back. Unlike Doug, I got mine presented by the President of the United States. last month, I got some kind of a recognition from the World Society of Victimology. And next week, I get an award from the Congressional Victim Rights Congress in Washington. And Doug's people are giving me an award next month. It's been an emotional retirement for me. I want to speak to two historical issues that come here. First place, what we're asking for was the birthright of every American when this nation was founded. Victims did not have to rely on the discretion of prosecutors or others to to run their cases. In fact, they were the prosecutors. Private prosecution was the only way to bring wrongdoers to justice. Victim participation was the only way to get business done. Some 30 or 40 years after the adoption of our Bill of Rights, the introduction of public prosecutor and police came into being, the victim was still a very active party for many years. That got whittled away until by the 1970s and 80s when we started this movement. The victim was a mere witness, ill-treated in the justice system. One of the great moving forces in the victim's movement was a study done in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C., which is the local prosecutor, to discover that witness non-cooperation is the greatest sabotage of successful prosecution. And the witness non-cooperation really added up to losing witnesses to the prosecutors and the police knew. They weren't walkaways. They were forced away. They were mistreated. It was the bureaucratic indifference and maltreatment of the citizens who had come forward earlier that caused these prosecutions to fail. And hence the growth of the victim witness movement, the victim rights movement. I mean, Kim spoke to some of the great services that those folks are now doing and to the gaps that are still there. Understand that victim rights, this participatory issues that we're talking about, grew out of, yes, victims' anguish, including the one that that Steve Dole mentioned, the Long Island father. But it also grew out of the work of the victim advocates and prosecutor's office. They saw the injustice of simply not giving the victims notice of what's coming up next. So that's a historical perspective. I would also add that historically, this represents a regeneration of the crime victims movement. 34 states have adopted an amendments to their constitution. We've had a hiatus of 4 or 5 years while we tried, Doug Maloof and I and others, tried to get the U.S. Congress to send to the states an amendment. That effort is now on the shelf. We took a deep breath, and now we're collectively, the same group that came together, the National Coalition, now said, now let's go back and see what needs to be done for the states that we haven't gotten or the states who have adopted amendments that need fixing. Oregon's the first state to come forward with that. California's trying to come along, but they're laggards. So let me speak to the Attorney General's committee on which I serve, the Advisory Committee on Victim Rights Compliance. I cannot tell you how impressed I am by the goodwill of the criminal justice folks who are on that committee. They are doing the victim rights job, unquestionably. I think they speak to a large portion of the current justice system that is honoring the rights that the voters enacted voluntarily. I commend them. But my hope is, and I think the committee in which I'm serving, our hope is that the guidelines that we're now crafting, these best practices, will be converted into regulatory procedures in pursuit of the authentic rights for victims. If the legislature and the voters do as we hope, the justice system will be miles ahead of other states in having procedures by which to get these rights absolutely enforced, by which to bring complaints administratively when they're not enforced, buttressed in the long run by the ability to sue for infractions. My experience over 35 years in this field is goodwill is an essential ingredient to treat victims decently. But goodwill has never been sufficient. Ronald Reagan, I think, summed it up best in his negotiations with the Soviet Union over arms control. His motto was, his watchword was, trust but verify. This is an effort to give victims that verification backup. Do we need it? I look at all this from a national perspective. The Attorney General indicated here that maybe 40% of the victims here are not getting their rights. I've seen this backsliding. I see it actually in one of the great offices, prosecutor's offices in the country, out in the Midwest. I won't mention Phil's name. But he's in the pantheon of prosecutors who are champions in this movement. I would add former DA John Collins in Oregon, and certainly Mike Schrunk. These were leaders of our field for a long time. Bill's office has slipped into weak consultation with victims. He got tired. He stopped wanting to be that mentor of all the new hires he had, all the new assistant TAs. And did they fall into bad habits? Yeah, they did. They're human. It is a problem that we all face. All the more reason to underscore the idea you have to have enforceable standards at the ready for those times when public bureaucracies fall into maltreating their clients. You don't have to use them, the very knowledge that they're there to hold the public officials accountable is an extremely effective way to get bureaucrats to do what they want. On the noncompliance issue, a national survey, and you have a lot of the data in my testimony, indicated that they surveyed states that had victim rights on the books and also states that had victim rights on the book with a constitutional amendment. I want to speak just to the ones that had the constitutional amendment in the mid-90s. About a third or more of the rights that were being they supposedly were offering were not accorded to victims. Now, these are simple rights, telling them about the availability of victim services, the right to discuss the case with a prosecutor. Let me pause on that. 95% of all cases, roughly, in this country brought by prosecutors are resolved by a plea bargain. If the prosecutor doesn't consult with the victim, then all of a sudden the one chance he or she has to comment on what justice is going to do goes out the window. In strong states, a third of the victims were denied that right. They were not informed of the right to speak in a parole hearing. And almost half of them weren't even informed of the right to speak at a sentencing hearing. Now, this is an outrageous record. Is it repeated in Oregon? We don't know for sure. The indicators are bad. But I ask you to take this perspective. If a third of criminal defendants were denied access to a lawyer or barred from appealing any unlawful procedures that saw to their conviction, or were otherwise denied their rights, we would be outraged and we would simply not stand for it. A one-third failure rate for violating defendants' rights is simply not acceptable. And I ask you to consider why can't we have the same set of values, ethos in the law and in our conduct for crime victims. The data indicates another, to me, even more troubling issue. It shows that there's racial bias in the application of victim rights laws. Now, sadly, that's not to be surprised at in our society. In their work, half the whites got all the rights that they were accorded. More than half got all the rights they were should have been accorded. Fewer than half of black victims did. To me, that is doubly offensive. I came into the public arena as a volunteer in the civil rights movement in the 60s. And so, those indicators of ongoing prejudice keep hurting me. I'm sure we have the same problems here in Oregon. But there's another dimension to this. And I want to pause on some personal experiences. When Robert Lee murdered my cousin in Bloomington, Indiana, my family was treated with the utmost courtesy. They had a special prosecutor because the DA in that county was conflicted out. So the special prosecutor drove 3 or 4 hours up from Evanston to meet my family and me on a weekend to review the case. He laid it all out for us, including all the weaknesses in the case, which happily got resolved with forensic testimony later on. It wasn't that Stan was consulting with us. We became friends. My cousin and I, who attended the trial, had to tease him from time to time. During voir dire, he'd take, there'd be a recess. We'd go out in the hall and he'd say, well, what do you think of number 9 as a potential juror? We said, Stan, you're the professional. We don't know. What do you think? I mean, it was that level of confidence. Now it's an unusual situation. It was a hugely publicized case. It was a matter of butchery by a serial killer. FBI couldn't find any other victims, but the butchery, the nature of the butchery was that of a serial killer. But it was a gratifying experience as a victim was treated properly. In contrast, a friend of mine who worked with me at Nova in Washington, a black person who, like too many black people in Washington, had a family member murdered. They had an arrest. They had a prosecution. It went to trial. And she and her family had cursory and totally unsatisfactory dealings with the prosecutors. Prosecutors, plural, kept bouncing from one to another. There were hearings and events in the case that they were told about after the fact. They were advised of the right to give an impact statement. I think they would have been advised anyway, but it certainly helped that my friend was also an employee of the National Organization for Victim Assistance. That was not right. That is a contrast that I think these numbers, the statistics indicate. Black folks and minorities and poor people, as the indication also is, have not been given their rights as they should. We need to change that. There's another dimension to this that I want to emphasize. When Fern and her family were irritated at the way they were treated, I think we can all understand it. I mean, here they are in great distress, looking to the government to give them some sense of redress. And they were treated like dirt, or that's the way they felt. Yeah, they could. You can understand their dimension. But I need to turn to the other side of this, and it's not much appreciated. When you're treated right, it is gratifying. I was asked to speak at Robert Lee's sentencing on behalf of my family. And I guess I choked up then, as I do here. But I got through it, and I did it not to influence the sentence, which is, of course, a dimension of the victim rights. He was going to get the maximum. There was no question about that. But I did it to give voice to Ellie, and to explain, if not to Robert Lee, who sat there right in front of me, blank, no emotional response, but at least to something, a world out there, how cruel he had been. And so I finished up. My aunt and uncle refused to attend the trial. But after she read the transcript of what I'd said, she called me up once more. Time after time, I talked to her in grief. But this is the one time that her tears had something to do with joy, with satisfaction, with appreciation. The transcript meant the world to her. I apologize. I cannot stress enough that the exercise of victim rights is a good and a healing and healthy thing. I have a dear colleague, Richard Barajas, whose brother was murdered in Albuquerque. The way he and his family were treated by the victim program and the prosecutors in Albuquerque was transformative for him. He left his criminal defense practice in West Texas and ran for DA and started the first victims program in that part of rural Texas. And he just retired as Chief Justice of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in Texas to teach law. And Doug, I trust you will keep me teaching victims law at Baylor Law School. Good treatment transforms people. And justice officials and justice agencies don't appreciate how wonderful good treatment adds up to. Well, let me go towards my conclusion. I am confident that the mere presence of the nominal rights in our Constitution here has done much to reform the treatment of victims in Oregon. I think that the goodwill I found on the committee is echoed and repeated all over the state. The failure rate may not be that 40% that I fear. It may be much smaller. But I'm just as certain that the justice officials who do the good right thing almost all the time will want to do the right thing every time when they know they can be called to account. On this, we have some experience. Doug Maloof made reference to the experience in Arizona, which has a victims' law clinic. Understand that states that their constitutional amendment predates ours. It's had enforceable rights all the way along. The culture of their justice system, I think, is even more advanced than ours in being receptive and friendly to victims and their interests. But they, every year, they get about 100 cases. This last year, involving 200 infractions of failure to tell victims of an upcoming event, to a denial of the victims to speak at the sentencing. They have a case or two which underscores the importance of having victims have an independent standing. Victims have gone into court to fight a subpoena for their psychological records, their medical records, and they did that on their own. They're winning all these cases. I think everybody in Arizona who has been called to account this way believe that these were minor infractions of the law. But they understand these were minor only in the eyes of the officials called to task. They were not minor to the victims who suffered the indignities, the lack of respect. I come to a final thought. You may hear from some who hold themselves out as being members of the civil rights, civil liberties bar, who pr- protest as they did in the past this reaffirmation of victims' rights. Their opposition galls me. The victims' movement has been called a coalition of bleeding-heart conservatives and hard-nosed liberals. Well, I come from the liberal camp. The criminal defense, civil rights, civil libertarians crowd, those are my people. And I don't like it that they oppose these reforms, because I think they all have a central human value at their core. We, in our democracy, in our constitutional system, put together ways to have the ordinary citizen be able to fight back when government bullies us. That's true for criminal defendants. That's true for the individual victim. And victims have, mostly through indifference, through a rush, through, you know, not evil intentions, but nonetheless, they've been bullied, as my friend Fern was in the Washington justice system. We have made this challenge year after year and year, and yet to get one answer. Ask these lawyers about their fear of how this is going to mess up defendants' rights. To review the many hundreds of thousands of criminal cases that have gone through the court system since these rights have been established, where the rights were enforced, and come up with an example where somehow or other enforcing those rights had been operated to the detriment of the defendant's rights. We have yet to hear of one such case. The fears that they speak of reminded me of the line from Franklin Roosevelt's inaugural address, where he talked about nothing to fear but fear itself. And then went on to describe that fear as nameless, unreasoning, and unjustified. And that's the charge that I lay before my friends, who have been opposing these efforts. You have an opportunity to restore, in this day, the measure of status and dignity that was the birthright of every American at the beginning of our country. And I thank you for your attention and for your respectful hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Stein. Thank each of the panel members for your compassion and your leadership on this issue. I also wanted to recognize Ms. Dee Dee Nones, who is one of the founders of Our Crime Victims United in Oregon. Do you have anything to say this morning, Dee Dee, or do you want to participate in this?
Oh, I always have a lot to say.
Thank you.
And you pronounce it
Coons. Thank you. Thank you, Dee Dee.
Thank you.
Okay, committee, we need to be on the floor at 10:30. If you have any questions, we have another panel of three. Thank you.
Just, if I may, Mr. Chair, very briefly, I want to thank you for testifying again, some of you again. And, Mr. Steiner, I really appreciate your testimony, human face, and things that people forget when we read a newspaper article and personal newspaper article about the death of somebody or the brutal murder of somebody. People often forget the pain, which is clearly coming to the surface, of those families. It goes on forever. It never ends.
Mary can't open her mouth without my crying.
Yeah. No. So
it happens often and often.
And just one other thing. I watched the news this weekend, and there's a family in Tennessee, a black family, who was shocked to see a murder of the father of the family suddenly get second-degree murder charges. This man who had told he owned an auto shop, some kind of wrecking yard, do not send black inspectors out. This black inspector went out, was murdered by this man, burned, dismembered, and pieces of his body put in different cars to be crushed to hide the crime. And it was going to be tried as a first-degree murder because of the racial implications. At the last minute, the defense got a couple African-Americans to sign things saying, oh, this guy's a nice guy, and he likes African-Americans. And so they thought their case might go. So without consulting the family, they went to second degree. 15 years the guy got. And the family went berserk in the courtroom, which was the news story because they had cameras there. But it just kind of, I think, tails in on what you're saying. Those kind of things where a family's not included in the plea bargain decisions can.
And understand, under these provisions, if a plea has been entered into without consultation, if the prosecutor had consulted with the family and disagreed with them, he would have honored the law. they would have been disappointed, but he'd honored the law, and there would be nothing wrong with the plea. But in the circumstances you're talking about, the family could go into court and tell the judge, stop the proceedings. Do not accept this plea until you order the prosecutor to do his duty to us.
Yeah, and the family asked that, and the court just said, no, we're moving on. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any other comments? Thank you very much, panel, for your testimony. It gives us our challenge ahead. The last panel, we have three other people to testify. We'll bring them up as a panel, Ms. Christian, Ms. Meyer, and Mr. Kroger. And panel, we need to be on the floor at 10:30. So.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, excuse me, my name is Ann Christian, and I'm with the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I recognize the time constraint. Contrary to what Mr. Stein indicated, his assumption, at least with regard to my organization, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, opposing this measure, I would note that when I signed up to testify, I noted that we had concerns with both HJR 49 and 50. And those concerns, I think, can be boiled down for brevity, even though I have lots to say. I will keep it brief. To two concerns. Number one, whether or not these provisions as far as enforcement of crime victims' rights, which the Oregon criminal defense lawyers recognize that Oregon crime victims have existing rights. They've had those rights since 1999. I was pleased to hear throughout the testimony that defense attorney or defense attorney investigator violations of those crime victims' rights are not at all, excuse me, I have this bad voice, are not at all the primary issue. Mr. Dole indicated that with his horrible tragedy that there was a violation with regard to the defense. And as I've told him before, any violation like that should be brought to the attention to anyone involved in the defense function. That leads to one of the concerns of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. We applaud the Attorney General for his efforts with his compliance and his noncompliance committees. I've reviewed, and I did go ahead and make copies for members of the excerpt from the report in 2002 with regard to Oregon crime victims' needs assessments. It's a report that actually is quite thorough, 215 pages, and I've just excerpted from it the portions on crime victims' rights and how they feel with regard to their rights being enforced. And my understanding is, as we sit here today, there is another survey that is underway by Portland State University. Our members are participating in that survey to the extent we can tell them to do anything, because we think it's important for everyone to participate in this, and it's like a 30-45 minute survey. So our point, one of two concerns about these measures, is number one, should these provisions be made in the Constitution, provisions for enforcement as opposed to statute? And you've heard the legal information from Attorney General Hardy Myers, Mr. Bloof, and others, and I agree with the Attorney General that the gateway change that must be made is to amend out of the Constitution the current prohibition. That's lines 4 and 5. On page 2 of HJR 49, because there is a constitutional impediment to allowing enforcement of crime victims' rights by statute. So Ms. Meyer will address proposed amendments that the OCDLA joins with the ACLU, and that is the intent, is to remove that prohibition from the Constitution. And then, as a legislative matter, address the statutory provisions with regard to how a victim's rights should be enforced. I agree with Mr. Stein that, bottom line, people should be treated nicely. They should be treated right. And I think a thorough discussion of some of the issues needs to occur. I greatly appreciate the opportunity this past week, last week, to be able to meet with the Deputy Attorney General, Pete Shepard. I think in the course of some meetings, we shed some light on his thinking and vice versa. And one of the things that caused me concern was trying to get information as far as what other states do. And the thing that I did first, and then I'm going to be quiet in 1 minute, is I looked to the federal government as far as what has the federal government enacted with regard to enforcement of victims' rights. And it's a statutory provision, and it has certain provisions that our organization really are concerned about. If a victim's right has been violated, and they don't even recognize that until the end of the case, under HJR 49, there's nothing that precludes them from bringing that up. The federal provision has a 5-day limit. Now, we could go on and talk and talk and talk about the difference between statutory provisions and constitutional provisions. I would simply say that when one is undertaking a new program, if you will, an important program, I think it's better to start in statute so that things are more easily amended. The second of our concerns is this is premature. I wonder how much of the difficulty even remaining today is because of lack of resources, whether in the district attorney's office or in the courts. And I think that an assessment, which I understand the Attorney General's committee is doing with regard to impediments to complying, really needs to be completed, and we get to see the results of the new survey. So with that, I will be quiet and answer any questions at the end of our panel.
Thank you. Is it Professor or Dr. Kroger, do you have some comments? Because we can continue the public hearing when we have the continuation or workshop if the professor wanted to go first.
I'm down here all the time, but I hope I'll have a chance to say something about this, but go ahead.
I'd be very glad to. I'll be very brief. John Kroger, I'm a law professor at Lewis and Clark Law School and a former federal prosecutor, and I'm here in a capacity as a private citizen to speak on behalf of the bill. If you look at the last 20 years, one of the most important things that's happened in the criminal justice system is to expand the rights of victims of crime to participate in the system, and that's had three very positive impacts. One is it allows the courts to make decisions after they've received all the information they need, particularly bail hearings and sentencing. They hear not only from the defense, from the government, but they also hear from the crime victims who often have a unique perspective. Second, it's ensured that restitution is not an afterthought, but a central part of a criminal case, so that if we can make people whole or come close to making them whole, there's a chance to do that. And third, and perhaps most importantly, it's ensured that crime victims are treated with dignity and respect. So having been victimized once by a perpetrator, and they're not victimized again by a callous system. In Oregon, we've done a good job of providing nominal rights to people. But as we teach in the first year of law school, a right without a remedy isn't a right at all. And that's what we've got here. The reality is that in some cases, prosecutors and courts do not accord crime victims the rights they should have. That happens, in my own belief, in part sometimes through carelessness and in part sometimes because of the burden of the caseload they've got. They're looking to do things swiftly and efficiently, and sometimes that means cutting corners. And sometimes that means crime victims don't get their rights respected. And the only way to ensure that they have a right to intervene at that point and get their day in court so that they can be heard is if they have the right to bring some kind of legal motion. I would also say, as a former prosecutor, that it's often in an extraordinarily difficult position for a prosecutor to be both an advocate for the people of the state and to look out for the rights of crime victims. In very many cases, the state's interests and the crime victim's interests are the same, but that is not always true. I've had cases where, as a prosecutor, I viewed the facts and the law very differently from the crime victims. Currently, prosecutors have a huge conflict of interest in those cases, and it's very difficult to deal with. And I think one of the most important things from a prosecutor's perspective about this bill is it ensures that prosecutors can look out for their primary duty and not have that conflict of interest. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Meyer.
Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. I implore you today not just to set this for another hearing and move it out to work session. The ACLU actually has some changes that we think will make this better and consistent, and we'd like to be part of that discussion. I know sometimes I come here and testify against something, but we're not, and I'm a little concerned today that we've not been able, and I don't have time to fully brief you on our dynamics and our concerns. We do think there should be a remedy for the violations of these rights set forth in the Constitution. However, we urge you to do it consistently with the other remedies and other provisions of the Oregon Bill of Rights. Right now, there's not sufficient remedies available for violations of Article 1, Section 8, our free expression provision, or Article 1, Sections 2, 3, and 5, our religious freedom provisions. We think this constitutional provisions do need to be changed to make it clear that victims do have rights, and then we think that the legislature should be given the authority to decide the scope of those rights. Our amendments, Dash 2 and Dash 3, respectively, actually probably need to be further tinkered to remove the language in the current provisions that say no remedies available and get rid of that, and then what we want to have is giving the legislature authority. This gets into a complicated area of Oregon constitutional law, but right now, as I said, and what we really need in the state is a mini-1983, that when you have a violation of the Oregon Bill of Rights, you can go to court and seek remedy. What happens is you can do that somewhat under the other provisions, but we run into mootness. Cases moot out, and part of the reason some of these amendments are in the original version is they're concerned about the courts not getting to them and them mooting out. And I'm being very quick. It's not going to be clear to all of you. I just want to highlight some of these things. So mootness is a problem. The problem goes away if by statutory we give authority to include damages, even nominal damages, so that the courts can actually adjudicate the case. So you've got the rights of victims and the rights of the defendants. And we don't want the rights of victims and their need to adjudicate their issues to supersede the constitutional protections of rights of the defendants. However, if there's not damages, if their situation isn't handled immediately by the courts, and there's a delay, if the defendant's action needs to go forward, that could moot out their case. Well, we don't want to moot it out, but we also don't want to perpetually delay and violate the defendant's constitutional rights. So how do you rectify that? You rectify that possibly by giving nominal damages, some way to keep the case live while the defendant's rights are preserved, but the victim gets an opportunity to adjudicate an issue. As we've heard testimony, it may be only one case every few years, but those can be important. But if we've got the mootness doctrine, which Oregon's the only state in the union to not recognize capable of repetition, these ideas happening over and over again, but an inability of the court to review it because the particular problem's gone away. The kid has graduated from school. The ballot measure has failed. These are ongoing issues. So that's a big core of what our amendments would do, is to basically focus in on removing the prohibition of rights to and remedies for victims. Also, we would want to add language that not only allows the district attorney to determine who the victim is, but also to give the courts. Those were parts of our objections to the earlier ballot measures. The victim is at the mercy of the prosecutor, and there are times when there are more than one victim, and there may be a situation where the prosecutor recognizes one of the victims but not the other. I believe prosecutors get it right almost all the time. But we should have a mechanism in this Constitution which gives the court, and that's one of our additional amendments, so it's the prosecutor or the court. So if a victim says, you got it wrong, DA, they have recourse to go to the court and get it right. And so that's a fix that we would also want. And then the new language we have and would balance and make sure that the rights of the defendants are not superseded, the rights in the Constitution of the defendants are not superseded by the victims, because as Attorney General Hardy Myers pointed out, they're changing some of the language about suspending an adjudication, a proceeding. And if you're suspending a proceeding for the defendant, you've got a problem potentially with constitutional violation. So thank you for your time. I hope that we will have a chance to better dialogue and maybe come to a place where we get something out there that improves this system, not for this portion of the Bill of Rights, but all the other ones. Thank you.
Thank you very much, panel. I'm sorry we had to rush. So, Mr. Attorney General, thank you for spending the time here and your leadership on this. So I'll adjourn the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 49 and House Joint Resolution 50.